I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Who is Vladimir Putin? He is set to win the Russian presidential election this weekend, but does anybody have a real idea of what kind of president he even wants to be? The election has been a done deal since New Year's Eve when Boris Yeltsin resigned the presidency and installed Putin as his successor. Putin is running a Rose Garden campaign. He's refused to debate the other 11 candidates or to run commercials on television. In one interview with a newspaper, he was asked, "Do you really have the desire to change all and everything?" "I won't tell you," was Putin's answer. Like the KGB spy that he was for 16 years, Putin is almost transparent. Westerners are calling him a reformer. Russians see him as a patriot who's crushing Islamic separatists in Chechnya. For the oligarchs and the tycoons, he's the candidate they've bought and paid for. Connection listeners, we're talking about Russia and the Russian elections this hour. Send in your absentee ballot. You can vote for Putin or for one of the 11 other candidates, or you can register a protest vote and cast a Niet ballot. None of the above. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Makes the Russia connection this hour. Richard Lurie, who's just back from Russia, joins us from a studio at the Radio Foundation in New York. Richard Lurie's latest book was a novel in which he presumed to write the autobiography of Joseph Stalin. The journalist Yevgenia Albats also joins us on the phone from Moscow. Richard Lurie, I wish we should just begin sort of filling us in, those of us who don't know Vladimir Putin from a cord of wood. Who is he? What is he like in our terms? And is he really all that popular in Russia today?
My instinctive take on Putin when I first saw him was, it's their Giuliani. He's a guy with a law enforcement, in quotation marks, in his case, background, who switched to politics. He's the kind of guy...
Rudy with rockets, we'll call him.
Rudy with rockets. I mean, he'll probably introduce some order into the rather chaotic Russian situation, and there'll be... And there already are, as far as in the war as Chechnya goes, considerable excesses. I mean, there'll be the equivalent of people getting shot at 41 times and hit 19 times in Moscow. On the other hand, I have to say that I spent a lot of time talking to a great variety of people when I was in Moscow for the last 15 days. And I would say the percentage of people who are actually enthusiastic about Putin or even about the war these days was very small percent. And some people accept him as an inevitability. Some people are against him. I heard maybe 5-10% of the people that I talked to, and I'm talking about regular people, not the intelligentsia and the highly placed officials, but just working stiffs. So the question is what kind of a mandate he's going to get. I mean, he'll win the election, but it's a question of what kind of support's under there.
Do ordinary Russians feel they're choosing this guy, or that he was simply thrust upon them?
I mean, definitely the latter. I mean, another joke that's going around these days is a kind of a variation on a Aesopian fable where a crow is sitting in a tree with a big piece of cheese in his mouth and a fox comes by and says, "Are you going to vote for Putin?" And the crow doesn't want to answer because he's afraid to open his mouth. So the fox repeats his question, "Are you going to vote for Putin?" And the crow remains silent. And finally, one more time, the fox says, "Are you going to vote for Putin?" The crow opens his mouth and says, "Yes." And the cheese falls out and the fox grabs it and runs away. And he looks back and says, "Even if you said no, you still would have lost your cheese." Idea being, yes, no, you're going to lose your cheese. Whatever whatever your cheese means in a given case. So there's a resignation, I would say, more than anything.
Where do they think he's coming from? Who's doing him? Who owns him? Who's running him? It reminds me of...
interesting.
You know, Silvio Poggioli's husband, Signor Benetazzo, is an eminently distinguished Roman journalist, and who covered Moscow for years. And somebody asked him once, what was the difference covering politics in Rome and in Moscow? And he said, it's very different. He said, in Moscow, you know nothing and you understand everything. In Rome, he said, you know everything and understand nothing. It sounds in Moscow as if people know nothing and understand everything as they always did.
Well, if he's owned by anybody, it's probably the, you know, the Borisovsky conglomerate. On the other hand, my guess is that he's a surprising fellow, Putin, and I think, Russia is a country that's unpredictable, maybe because they've never had a middle class, which they desperately need, and they've never had a middle ground in their thinking or in their acting, and so in the 20th century, if you just take Rasputin and Stalin, to take two examples of sort of larger than life figures among many others, I'd rather bet a small sum of money that once Mr. Putin is firmly established in power, he's going to do a few surprising things. He may clean house in ways that no one expects, and people that are said to own him may find out that was a short-term lease.
I want to go to Moscow, but can I just throw out for Moscow and you, Richard Lurie, one other thought? People refer to him, and we were calling him Rudy Giuliani with rockets, but people also call him a healthy Andropov, the ex-KGB guy who didn't quite make it there before Mikhail Gorbachev. What would a healthy KGB candidate want to be doing in that job?
Well, that projection or that concept has to do with the fact that he has an intelligence background, so therefore you could assume that he's well informed and knows how to think, because those are supposedly two essential aspects of that job, and that he'll be iron-willed and that he'll introduce the kind of order that Russians are longing for these days. I'll just give you a simple example. I was talking to a publisher in Moscow and who had started out as a kind of small mom-and-pop operation and had now reached what we would consider very modest proportions, but already of in terms of income, significant enough to attract the attention of organized crime. So that publisher is now in the position where he has to choose his roof, as the Russians say. What roof is he going to have over his head? Is he going to pay one of the mafias to protect him from the other mafias, or is he going to sort of join a larger publishing organization which already has its roof? So I think for a Russian who's trying to simply do business and trying to create that middle class that I was talking about, the fear of crime, which is mostly on that level, I felt that Moscow was a very safe city. People aren't talking about crime on the street level. But a guy who's trying to start a business knows that once he reaches a certain modest level of income, he's no longer his own man. And that's... an economy can't grow in any normal sense like that.
Evgeny Albats in Moscow, give us a Russian's view of this black box, as people call him, Vladimir Putin. Who is he? Who runs him? What do you expect from him?
Well, I don't think that he's a black box anymore. I think that this question, who is Mr. Putin, no longer exists. His blind interviews to Russian press and to the journalist who did his book from the first person, it is quite clear he's a KGB man who had a pretty unsuccessful career in the KGB. He praises violent force over the power of argument, clearly, and that's what he was taught during his KGB career. He's what I would call an extreme statist. Mm-hmm. He's the one who thinks that state goes first, and the questions of personal liberties, freedoms, human rights are secondary consideration. He's also the one who spent the last 9 years in pretty liberal circles.
This is the deputy mayor of Petersburg?
Well, he was for 6 years. He was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, and then 3 years he spent in Kremlin. So he probably believes in the market economy, or at least he believes that capitalism is more efficient way of running the economy rather than Soviet-type planned economy. He's seeking Russian greatness. He would like to reinstate Russia is a real power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who doesn't understand conception of human rights entirely. It's clear also. He has a reputation of pretty honest guy, deeply religious. So he's not that much black and white, I would say. But obviously, should anyone told me, you know, 4 years ago that our next president is going to be a former KGB man, I would probably consider it as a bad dream, as a joke, but it happened.
This is fascinating.
Who runs him, who owns him, I don't think it's proper to say, to put it this way. Obviously, there is a clear-cut fight, undercarpet fight, between several clans. There is also the fight between his KGB pals and oligarchs, some group of oligarchs. However, I don't think that anyone can claim that he owes him. Not that easy.
Well, David Remnick, writing about this election and Berezovsky, the great oligarch behind him, also quotes people, including Berezovsky, saying, you know, riding that sort of tiger is dangerous. Berezovsky could end up in prison. He could end up stripped. It's hard to say whether a bought politician in Moscow stays bought. But I'd also like you to just deal with another sort of general contrast. After Yeltsin, Yeltsin was drunk, Putin is dry. Yeltsin was a romantic populist. Putin is a kind of pragmatic bureaucrat. Yeltsin was magnificently Russian. Putin seems kind of Germanic and tight. Is this what people want to? What do they think they're getting in the? This is the Yeltsin succession. It's also an enormous contrast.
Yeah, well, you know, Putin in a way is an anti-Yeltsin. That's definitely true. We still, you know, we yet to know how good he will be as a president. I mean, how effective he will be as a president. It's not clear now because all he did by now is the savage war in Chechnya. As to why people vote not because Putin was imposed on them. It's the kind of the Western approach that would like to, you know, all of us to see some conspiracy theories behind such things in Russia. No, people vote for him because he's one of them. Putin is an ordinary man. He's the one who reflects the sick, perplexed, and lost Russian society. If you look at the polls, I'm looking different polls. You will clearly see that he has support in all ilks of the society. Whether we're talking about intelligentsia, whether we're talking about those urban dwellers or people from the villages, he has very broad support. Many people here in Moscow ask me, since, you know, once I authored a book on KGB, how is it possible that Russians are ready to vote for a KGB man, having in mind that 40 million families in Russia lost their close ones to Gulag. But the truth is that 70% of those who were asked by the pollsters, are you concerned about Putin's KGB past, said no, we are not concerned. Unfortunately, these years, last 9 years of broad corruption among the elites, of humiliation, of abandoning of the welfare state, and etc., all these years showed to many Russians that democracy is quite a difficult way to survive, that you have to take care about your own life, you have to be responsible for your family, and 70-plus decades of the Soviet rule taught people to be quite infantile. So I think that people are looking for a strong hand who will be capable to help them to go through difficult years to some tomorrow paradise. So to make a long story short, Putin is going to be a Russian president not because what he did before or what he claims to do in the future, but because who he is. And he's the one who reflects the Russian society. The state of mind, the understanding of the values of the democratic values, and etc. It's, I mean, it's not pleasant to hear, especially, you know, you understand how I should feel. But unfortunately, that's the reality, and it's a good idea not to create any more myths. I think it's healthy for West to stop looking for miracles and to expect miracles. Democracy doesn't surface overnight. So that's it.
Okay. Yevgenia, do I take it that you mean when people say, or they wink, or they can deal with his KGB past, part of it is a sort of nostalgia for the confidence and the preeminence of the Soviet state in the good old Soviet days? Is there a little bit of that echo in this democratic mix?
No. So, I would say that those who 10 years ago opened archives, including KGB archives and Central Committee of the Communist Party archives, those who spoke about all the evils of the Soviet Empire, those people who got into power then and who were acknowledged in the corruption and all kinds of misdoings, they devaluated the democratic idea in Russia. And so since absolute majority of Russians never read Archipelago Gulag by Solzhenitsyn,
yes,
they just heard something about that. And besides, you know, the problems that KGB created in Russia during the last 20 years of the Soviet regime, it was a problem for, in fact, a very small percentage of people. For those people in intelligentsia, for scientists, for journalists, for writers, but for absolute majority of Soviet people, it was some distant evil. They had nothing to do with him after the end of Stalinist terror. So for them, it's not, I mean, they don't see KGB as a monster because they don't have the real experience of freedom. They don't value this sense of freedom.
Yevgenia, I want to go to calls. We're talking about the next Russian president to be elected on Sunday. By all accounts, it'll be overwhelming. Vladimir Putin, where the old KGB and the new experiment in Russian democracy meet. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 with the journalist Yevgenia Albats in Moscow and the author and translator, the translator of Sakharov's books, Richard Lurie, with us from a studio in New York. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to say hi also to Mrs. Albats. I worked in Moscow for about 3 years, from 95 to 98, during Yeltsin's reelection. And I'd just like to ask her, as a journalist, what her opinion is in terms of all the freedoms that have been won since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Especially, I think one of the main freedoms is the freedom of the press, as we've seen in the reporting from Chechnya and so on. Recently, Putin was quoted as saying that he has a different understanding of freedom of the press or freedom of expression. This is an article in New York Times. I'd like to ask her, do you think that he can succeed in rolling back some of these freedoms, or are they too ingrained? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Yevgenia.
Yes.
Are these new freedoms in danger?
Yes. Yes, I do think. But it's, you see, it's never been easy during the last years to publish any real balanced and good investigative journalism in Russia. Putin doesn't have to crash on journalists. He doesn't have to ask him people, you know, to call Evgeny Alberts and say, don't do this. He, since media are owned by few tycoons, all he has to do is to press them. And then they will introduce certain censorship in the newspapers and channels. In fact, we see it already. So, to make the long story short, yes, it's going to be much more difficult.
David Remnick, who knows Russia well, in the New Yorker, makes the media giants the operative powers here. And what they've done in this election is absolutely destroy anybody, including the mayor of Moscow, who might have been a plausible candidate for office, by rumor, by sort of Jerry Springer scandal, by sexual innuendo, by the most, infinitely bigger than kind of National Enquirer kind of semi-ridicule, semi-expose, hit-and-run sort of demolition journalism. What does that tell us, Richard Lurie?
Well, I just wanted to add one thing. That this is sort of coming in at a slight angle, but just before I was leaving Moscow, I was talking to a staff reporter for the magazine Itogi, which is kind of the equivalent of Newsweek, but on a much higher intellectual level, I would say. And they had just received a sort of edict or suggestion or whatever exactly it should be called from the Ministry of Information, stating that direct quotation of Chechen terrorists would be considered aiding and abetting terrorism. So, in a sense, that's is a perfect example of the way that the state can even directly pressure freedom of expression. I think that's the one thing that we're going to have to watch the most carefully, because in a sense, it's the most precious and important, and it's also the most visible aspect of Russian society that could be lost. If the press starts to really be put under terrific pressure, we're going to know that, and that can't be kept a secret. And that, I think, that'll tell us more about the real Mr. Putin than any polls or any predictions. Well, and another thing, this is a quick little snapshot from Moscow when I just returned. I think it tells us something relevant to what Yevgenia was saying about the lostness of today's Russia. I was over at the Physics Institute of the Academy of Sciences, and the physicists were saying, you know, they can't get used to the new form of address, they say, which is Gospodin, which is actually an old form of address, but basically it means Mr. But everybody has gotten, can no longer say Tovarish, which means comrade. So they found themselves in the funny position of not knowing even how to address each other, which tells you something about a society. It's a trivial detail, and yet it kind of points to a kind of absolute loss of orientation. If you want to speak to a stranger, you don't even know quite anymore how the basic social form of social intercourse takes place. And while I was there, the physicists, we were strolling through this rather impressive set of buildings, and this often happens in Moscow, the physicists said with this funny mixture of pride and shame, oh, these buildings were built by German prisoners of war after the end of the Second World War. The pride is that they defeated the German army and put them to work repairing the country that they had invaded and destroyed. The sort of secret shame there is the implication that the Germans would build a better building than the Russians. And to the degree that you referred to this earlier, that Putin there is something Germanic about Putin, efficient and dry and not in the least in the typical Russian tradition of in which Yeltsin more or less was. I think Remnick made reference to the novel Oblomov, where
yes.
the sort of the Oblomov character is very Russian, very simpatico, but he can't get anything done, and it's only Stoltz, the vigorous, boring yet efficient German, who manages to accomplish anything. And some of that complex is fluttering in the air as well.
Could I just ask you both, and maybe Yevgenia first, what does Moscow feel like these days in its kind of evolution as a capitalist capital, but also does it feel like a city and a capital at war these days?
No, definitely it's not the capital at war, but I think that Moscow feels quite perplexed. In fact, polls show that Moscovites are going to give less votes to Putin than the rest of the country, in fact, two times less.
Hmm.
So I think that for Moscow intelligentsia, I think, you know, you see, Moscovites, Moscow intelligentsia probably got the most out of these 9 years of the reforms. Got the most in terms of freedom, of the possibility to read books, to write, to see movies, to go abroad, to make money, to do shopping.
Yevgenia, hold the thought. We're going to come back after a short break. We're talking about the foregone conclusion that Vladimir Putin will be elected president of Russia on Sunday. Give him a call. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston, New York. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, the Russia connection, on the eve almost of the presidential elections that will almost certainly make Vladimir Putin the successor to Boris Yeltsin in the Russian presidency. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guests are the journalist Yevgenia Albats in Moscow and the novelist and translator Richard Lurie, who wrote Joseph Stalin's autobiography. He's with us from a studio in New York, just back from Russia himself. 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to ask you, Yevgenia, and allowing that Al Gore versus George W. Bush is not exactly a battle of titans, perhaps, nonetheless, the Russian election just doesn't seem to have the fire, the spice, the interest, the contest that we might have hoped for if, say, the former Prime Minister Primakov or the mayor of Moscow, Lyushkov, were in it. What happened here? Why? And speak, if you like, about your own disappointment in the choice that's been offered to Russian voters on Sunday.
First of all, you know, I wasn't happy about Mr. Primakov and Mr. Lushkov. Mr. Primakov is a sort of the same Putin, only grounded in the past, in the planned economy. So Putin versus Primakov, from my perspective, is better, even though probably he will be sort of a harsh leader. Talking about Lushkov, by no means I will ever vote for Lushkov. The sort of the regime he created in Moscow, it's a corporate type of government. It's the reflection of the most corrupted government I've ever read about in many books, even on Latin America. So in this way, you know, I'm not sorry that they drop off, and they did it not because, you know, not only because there was a harsh campaign against them, but also because they themselves made a lot of mistakes. My personal choice will be Grigory Yevlinsky, of course. It's not that I'm very happy about Yevlinsky, but choosing between Putin or against all voting and Yevlinsky, I choose to vote Yevlinsky.
Yevlinsky is still on the ballot. He's the sort of Kennedy School at Harvard candidate, a pretty reasonable Western-minded guy. Whatever happened to him?
Yeah, only, you know, he has You know, I'm not sure that he has balls. I'm sorry. But that's another question.
Richard, did you expect...
It's a tough job to be a politician in Russia.
It's a tough job
in any country, but in a country where there are no history of democracy whatsoever, no history of the free press whatsoever. I mean, we're not just talking about 70 years of Soviet rule, but also, you know, the 1,000-year history of Russia never knew freedom of press, freedom of expression, freedoms in general. So it's a tough job to be a politician here, and you have to be good in explaining to people your goals. You have to be tough. You have to bring people the idea how you're going to improve their lives. And unfortunately, Russian democratic movement was extremely split, dispersed during these years. And in fact, you know, what's happening now is what we did via our own hands. We, people who believe in liberal democracy, we are responsible for what's going on now. It's our mistake. So...
Could I ask you...
Chris, I can tell you how I feel. I feel like crying.
Oh.
You know, I started doing investigation on KGB back in 1986. I published my first book on KGB, Time Bomb, in 1991. I was absolutely sure that those guys have all the possibilities to return back. I wrote this in my 1995 book on KGB that came out in the States. And we ourselves brought them back into power. We did it via our own hands, because it appeared that our great Democrats, you know, so devoted Democrats, they were much more devoted to their personal pockets rather than to the idea of institutionalizing the democracy in Russia. We appeared to be so weak, so silly. And I can tell you, honestly, I don't want to go back. I lived under the Soviet rule, so, you know, big chunk of my life, and I badly don't want to go back.
Yevgenia, speak about the one woman candidate among the 11, Ella Pamphilova.
Ella Pamphilova.
What about her?
Yes. I mean, it's good that in... Russian male chauvinist society that woman is running for a presidency. Obviously, she has no chance. It's quite difficult to talk about her views. I think she's a pretty honest person, and that's probably it.
She's going to get a certain percentage of the protest vote of the people who are simply unable to bring themselves to vote for Putin and yet don't want to surrender the possibility of expressing their political views through the ballot box. At least when I was in St. Petersburg, a lot of people that, this is again the intelligentsia, which represents a teeny segment of society, but I was surprised. They said, well, we're going to vote for Pamphilova because she's basically a decent person and she's a woman and she's not Putin. And that was enough for them. And she'll probably get maybe 1 or 2%,
She will get well below 1%. Well below 1%.
People, I mean, the close watchers of this thing say that turnout is a very delicate measure of the Russian mood here. What will we learn from that? Richard?
I mean, I agree with Yevgenia on the point that Putin is to some degree a reflection of the times and in a sense a reflection of the sort of future that the people seem to have decided they want. Not so much, you know, democracy is a little bit tarnished and in bad odor, and I think that Putin's iron hand, if that's what we're going to see, policies won't ruffle a lot of feathers among the general population. But my guess is that the turnout is not going to be so great. And the reason that in the BBC news piece that opened the program, Putin had gone on the air in Russia asking people to come out and vote, because I think the fear is that the indifference is greater than people think. Although the Russians have been voting in sort of very admirably large percentages in their recent elections, my intuition, and it can only be that in a country that huge based on my completely unscientific sampling of the population, is that the turnout is not going to be that big and it may have to go two rounds.
Hmm.
I don't know what Yevgeny thinks.
Yevgeny, we'll come back to it.
I do think that the turnout will be lower than during the parliamentary elections in December. I mean, I think it will be below 60%. Hmm. It's probably will be, you know, somewhere around 50%. I do agree with you that there is a possibility for the runoff. There is a possibility for that. Yevlensky is speaking up in the big cities during the last days. You see, we clearly see that Putin is losing about 3-5% each week.
Hmm.
So should elections happen in the time scheduled, I mean in June, he'll probably have lots of troubles. But that's exactly why those Kremlin gatekeepers did their best so that Yeltsin resigned on December 31st and Putin would have all the possibilities to win the elections.
The other thing is, I mean, I think it's an important factor which we haven't touched on at all, is that Putin's rise, I mean, in popularity, was largely tied to what seemed to be the early successes in the war against Chechnya, or the war with Chechnya, however you want to say it. But a lot of bodies have been coming back lately, and they've been coming back to the bigger cities like Moscow and Pskov, and the funerals have been televised, and there's a sense now, I mean, this is my pickup again, but there's a sense now that this war is not going to end. It's not going to be a short, victorious war, to use an expression that led Russia into a catastrophe with Japan in 1904. It's not going to be short, and it's not going to be victorious. And even if it is victorious in a kind of a devastation kind of a sense, like Grozny can be said to be a city that's been defeated by the Russian federal troops, but at the cost of destroying it, I think the guerrilla warfare aspect, the terrorism aspect, has yet to be really thought through by those people, and or at least publicly discussed. So, yeah, shoot.
Yevgenia?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Richard, for interrupting you.
No, that's how I was done.
Let's go to a call. Stand by, Yevgenia. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Russia connection. Maka is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, welcome.
Hello, Chris. My question is, a couple of weeks ago, there was two meetings with two Russian politicians, Sergei Grigoryev and Stepashin. Both of Russian politicians underlined that the people in Russia are happy with war in Chechnya. I can understand that politicians like Stepashin and Grigoryev are happy with war, but I couldn't understand why the people are happy with the war and Putin.
You probably mean not Sergei Grigoryev, because I don't know a politician by the name Sergei Grigoryev. Probably means Sergei Kiriyenko, the former Russian prime minister. Unfortunately, that's exactly what polls show. 70% of Russians believe that a war in Chechnya should be continued till the victorious end. That's meaning the extermination of the entire male population of Chechnya. And 50% of them consider that war should be continued even if the amount of dead bodies coming from Chechnya will mount. So that's the story.
No matter that the bodies, as Richard Lurie says, are coming back, that changed a lot
as
of thinking.
As I said, 55% having been asked if the amount of those killed in Chechnya, Russian soldiers who killed in Chechnya will increase during the next weeks. Do you still consider the war in Chechnya to be continued? And the 55% said yes, They were sure.
I mean, the thing is, polls are polls. Polls are polls, and people change them. You know, it's easy to say you're for the war in Chechnya if you don't have a son or 17 and over. I mean, I don't put a great deal of faith in that. My principal worry about that war is that the Russians will essentially win it. The Chechens will start becoming very inventive in their terrorism. In 1995, in November 1995, the same leader, who's Shamil Basayev, who's essentially running the Chechen show now, announced to the press that he had planted cesium, which is a form of low-grade form of radioactive material, in his Izmailovo Park, one of the main parks in Moscow. The press went, and sure enough, there it was. That incident tends to haunt me because if he did it in 95, he can do it in 2000. And Andrei Sakharov, when in the middle 80s, wrote frequently about the danger of the old Chernobyl-style nuclear reactors, which, if hit even by a conventional shell or a Stinger or a howitzer shell, it can produce a nuclear incident. So the opportunities for mischief are very great on that side. And what I'm really worried about is the Russians will win the war. The Chechens will revert to extreme terrorism, which in turn will produce and justify a further authoritarian clampdown by Putin. This is down the road. So that it's a kind of a funny situation. If Russia wins the war, do they really win? I mean, no one seems to. And one of the problems with this war is that journalists are afraid to go to Chechnya because the Chechens have been kidnapping people left and right. Many Russian war correspondents told me that they were willing to go to a battlefield and take the chance of getting hit by a stray bullet, but they were unwilling to go to a battlefield and have themselves get kidnapped and have a finger a week sent back for ransom purposes. The war has been very sparsely covered from the battlefield's point of view for that very reason.
Could I ask you both to consider Vladimir Putin as the sort of the last phase for a while of the Yeltsin story and the story of the man who kind of saw Russia into democracy and markets and then in a certain way seem to just fall apart personally. What is the Putin succession going to say about the man he succeeds, Boris Yeltsin? Yevgenia, would you start that?
Chris, I think that Yeltsin made a very dangerous investment. He invested his future into Putin. And Yeltsin is a sort of a guy who cares about his image in the history textbooks. So I think he made quite a dangerous investment.
The other possibility is that Yeltsin was always more cunning than people took him for. And he may have turned, I mean, Putin may prove yet to be not so much the bad guy that everybody is fearing, but he may turn out to be a fall guy, because if he can't really win this war and if he can't get the sort of wealth, by the way, we were talking a little bit about Moscow as a city. I mean, my impression is that this is a city that's become almost a normal European capital. 24-hour-a-day city, plenty of restaurants, plenty of shopping, interesting art galleries, interesting bookstores, a city that's where there's a lot going on. The closest equivalent I can think of is East Berlin. Anyway, that's a kind of a digression. Point being, in this fable of this ongoing fable of Russian history, he may turn out to have been the fool who's been handed the war, the ailing economy, and the political mess. And yes, if he fails, it'll reflect badly on Yeltsin. But he may turn out to be the fall guy and not the bad guy, which would be a kind of an ironic twist.
No, Chris, you know, I mean, I just hate to contradict Richard in any move, but...
Why not?
First of all, you know, it's sort of reflection of, you know, perception of reality. But reality is not exactly perception. First of all, you know, there is a good team of economists around Putin, pretty liberal. I mean, very liberal, I would say. And they will try to do their best in that respect. I think he wins war in Chechnya. And he will put money into secret services and military so to make it difficult for Chechens to travel outside the Caucasus. In fact, all these fears about another Chernobyl committed by terrorists, they were 4 years ago, and, you know, during the last 3 years where Chechnya had a semi-independence and there were no real authority inside Russia, they never tried even to do this. You know, I can reassure you that secret services are capable to keep track on those objects. So I don't expect such disasters. Obviously, this guerrilla war will never end. I mean, the last Caucasian war lasted for 100 years, so it will be, you know, ongoing war. But it will be in Caucasus, not outside Caucasus. What's bad about that is that the military expenditure will increase, that the role of militaries in Russia will increase, and probably Putin will choose militaries as his social base, especially if he starts the war against oligarchs. So these in turn will bring more restrictions on civil society, press, and et cetera, of course, as we already seen it.
Could I ask you,
When I said that Yeltsin made a quite a dangerous investment, I meant a bit different thing. I meant that Yeltsin does want to see himself in the history books as the first democratic president of Russia. And obviously, by choosing Putin as his heir, you know, it may turn out that people will write that Yeltsin was unable to create a real democracy in Russia, so someone who succeeded him was able, you know, to turn it some clocks back. So
Ted Koppel has the news story on page one of the New York Times this morning. In an interview with Putin, Putin says that he'll use KGB members to, I mean, KGB staff to root out corruption, that he's also already gone to his old friends in the KGB to staff the Kremlin. Is this news in Russia, and does it matter?
Of course it's not news in Russia. Do you think that we receive news from New York Times? Chris, come on.
Are you upset about it?
I'm very upset about that, of course. I'm very upset because, I mean, I do understand that Russia needs to have an effective and efficient secret service to fight terrorism, to fight organized crime, to fight drug smuggling, to fight weapons smuggling, etc. But it's not their job to be in Kremlin. They don't know this job, first of all. And the way they know it is nothing good for the civil society in Russia.
Richard,
so that's why, of course, I'm upset.
Richard Lurie, are you reassured that, as Yevgenia Abbott says, sort of the simplest bumper sticker on Vladimir Putin's mind, the sort of it's the economy stupid equivalent, is he wants to be remembered as Russia's first democratic president. Does that help?
That Yeltsin wants to be remembered as...
That Putin wants to be remembered as the...
As Russia's first democratic president?
Yeah.
I don't think that's the bumper sticker. I think the bumper sticker reads something like "Watch out," or "Out of my way." And the one thing that I have to say that Yevgenia said in passing that I just want to highlight for Western
Please.
Viewers is she said in talking about Putin, former KGB agent and deeply religious man, and I just wanted for a second to bring those two points back together and savor them because it is a very sort of unusual and maybe very very Russian combination, and maybe that tells us something about Putin too that we haven't talked about. But deeply religious KGB agent is a hard thought for me to get.
we'll work on it over the weekend as we wait for the returns. Richard Lurie, thank you as ever. Yevgenia Albat, always a pleasure. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WDUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Institute of Contemporary Art, featuring the work of British artist Cornelia Parker on exhibit through April 9th, 266-5152, or on the web at icaboston.org. By Fox Relocation Management, providing customized facilities.